This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The ongoing Palestinian uprising, known as the Intifada, erupted in December of 1987. It started in the largest refugee camp in the Gaza Strip and spread to the West Bank. Both territories have been occupied by Israel since 1967. My guest, Ehud Ya'ari, is the co-author of a new book about the Intifada. He says that neither the Israelis nor the PLO expected the rebellion to last. But the longer it drags on and the more casualties it claims, the more distrust it generates between Palestinians and Israelis. Ehud Ya'ari covers Middle East affairs for Israeli TV. His co-author, Zev Schiff, is the military correspondent for the Israeli daily Haaretz. Their new book is called Intifada. I asked Ya'ari about the current status of the Intifada.
Well, I would say that we have reached a point where both parties, Israelis and Palestinians, have exhausted most of their potential fighting each other. That is, the Israelis will face a lot of difficulty trying to crush the Intifada completely and wipe the Intifada off the face of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. I don't think we can do it. And if I may add, I don't think we should do it. And the Palestinians, I think, have realized by now that they cannot wipe out the Israeli army from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Probably they cannot wipe out Israeli settlements from these territories. And both parties are probably very close by now, in spite of the fact that it doesn't seem to be so very often. I think that both parties are very close to realization that they have to sit down and try to discuss the matter in a more proper manner.
Let's talk a little bit about the background of the Intifada. You say that Israel initially said that the uprising was inspired by Syria and the PLO, that the Syria and the PLO were behind it. But you contest that. You say this was really a rebellion of the poor.
Yes. My colleague Zev Schiff and myself, we have reached the conclusion that the power of the Intifada, the energy of the Palestinian uprising, stemmed from a simple, well-known rebellion of the poor. The poorest of the poor amongst the Palestinians, we call them the angry proletariat of Israel. Only at a later stage were people who are loyal advocates of the PLO able to transform the uprising into a politically motivated and directed revolt. But it took at least 2 months before this was possible. And I think both politicians on the Palestinian side of the fence, also politicians on the Israeli side of the fence, are very reluctant to admit that the main reason for the outbreak of the Intifada were the main reasons were socioeconomic. That is, the distress, the humiliation, the poor economic conditions of many of the Palestinians in the territories. And for example, during the first wave of demonstrations back in December 87, most of the people detained in the streets by the Israeli security forces were not known to the interrogators, were not known to our intelligence. And the officers were simply faced in the detention camp with people they didn't know, and they didn't expect them to be participants of such violent demos. And when they started talking to them and ran a few questionnaires, they reached the conclusion that people mainly felt that they were being humiliated under the occupation, that their life conditions were unbearable, and not because they wanted to demonstrate for a certain national aspiration. That is, people took to the street because they felt that their life were not good enough, not because they felt that they have to support Mr. Arafat's call for an independent Palestinian state. At the same time, you will find it difficult to get any Israeli politician to admit that life of the many Palestinians under what we used to consider a benign occupation were so difficult as to get people to take to the streets. So it is easy, just as well, to Israeli politicians, all shades of the political spectrum, to blame foreign powers, PLO, Syria, Iran, whatever, for what happened during the Intifada.
Well, you think that Arafat initially underrated the uprising and that was a grave mistake. And then when he realized how important it was and how much energy was behind it, he tried to make it seem like the PLO was leading the uprising. How did he try to get control?
The first few weeks of the Intifada were almost pathetic in what concerns Arafat. I mean, the guy was on the telephone, him and his lieutenants, but also him personally, trying to locate who were the people leading the demonstrations on the streets, especially in the Gaza Strip. He didn't know, just as the Israeli intelligence didn't recognize this new gallery of faces on the streets. However, through an initiative taken without reference to Arafat by local activists of one faction of the PLO, which is the Democratic Front for Liberation of Palestine, a small neo-Marxist group with an elitist approach to Palestinian politics, these people initiated the formation of what they called at the time the Unified National Command and started issuing leaflets giving instructions to the population on how to behave and how to carry on with this rebellion. Arafat have managed, after 2 or 3 months, to maintain, to impose, or I would rather say to reimpose, PLO supremacy and patronage over the Unified Command, in spite of the fact that a strong tension and strain existed, still does, between the insiders, that is the Palestinians on the inside the territories occupied by Israel, and the outside leadership of the PLO. The fact that the Israeli Security Service was able, by March 88, that is 3 or 4 months after the outbreak of the Intifada, to arrest most of the leading members of the Unified Command, made it easier for Arafat to take control and prove to the insiders that they have to listen to PLO Tunis, to the leadership which is outside Israel, because they cannot sustain and they cannot escape arrest by the Israelis. So it's a very strange situation where, in fact, the Israelis, by arresting and crushing the Unified Command in the West Bank, were helping their enemy, Mr. Arafat, regain control over the population.
My guest is Israeli journalist Ehud Ya'ari, and he's co-authored a new book called Intifada, the Palestinian Uprising, Israel's Third Front. How much control did Islamic fundamentalist groups have?
During the Intifada, we have witnessed a sharp transformation of the Islamic fundamentalists in the territories. These people traditionally, historically, emphasized education, prayers, not political action. However, under the pressure of the Intifada, with the tens of thousands of people streaming into the streets and trying to attack the Israeli army bases and Israeli convoys, trying to block the roads and barricade inside the villages, etc., the fundamentalists found that they have to join the wave and try to take the lead. So the main organization that was formed during the Intifada, and this is a new phenomenon, is Hamas, the initials for the Islamic resistance movement. And I would say that by now, if a poll was taken in the territories, I believe that these people would easily gain about a third of the vote, which is something to bear in mind if at any point from now on we are going to have elections in the territories as suggested by the Israelis, accepted by the Palestinians, and now sponsored by Secretary Baker. Islamic fundamentalism has become a very important phenomenon in Middle East politics by and large. And if we try to take a good look at what's happening to the Palestinians, then we will see that whenever we had elections in the past year, that is, elections for the Jordanian parliament, 80% of the Palestinians in Jordan voted for fundamentalist candidates. In Israel itself, we had recently two rounds of election. One was for municipal elections and the other was for the trade unions. And in both, the results, the score won by the fundamentalists was quite impressive. So there is a situation now that the PLO supremacy amongst the Palestinians is being contested by the Islamic fundamentalists. And my own personal feeling is that the longer it takes us to reach the negotiations table, the easier it's going to be for the Islamic fundamentalists to gain more following in the territories.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but the impression I get from your book is that you think the PLO rhetoric is more against the government of Israel, Israeli policies, whereas the Islamic fundamentalist rhetoric is more anti-Jewish.
That's true. There are very strong anti-Semitic undertones to the Islamic fundamentalist literature. They have, for example, published their covenant, which is supposed to be the platform, the overall political platform of the Islamic movement, the Palestinian Islamic movement. And a great part of it is devoted and dedicated to quotations from the protocols of the Elders of Zion. In their brochures, in their leaflets, which are very often distributed in the territories, the struggle is portrayed as a struggle between the good Muslims and bad Jews. The PLO has been, until recently, very careful to portray the struggle as a confrontation between two nations, and as of last year, the PLO is taking the position that they are willing, in principle, to accept the right of Israel to exist as a Jewish state. But under the pressure of the Islamic rhetoric and the propaganda, recently I have noticed some, for the first time, by the way, some anti-Semitic literature being published by the PLO. Most recently, an article, which I thought was outrageous, an article which denied the Holocaust during World War II. And I think that the PLO are under a lot of pressure because of the advances made by the Islamics. And sometimes, because they fear confrontation, because Mr. Arafat believes that he should prevent an open split amongst the Palestinians, they submit to them, and the PLO is bow their heads to the Islamics instead of debating them openly.
We've talked a little bit about how the leadership has changed in the occupied territories during the Intifada. Let's take a look at what's happened in the Israeli government, in the Israeli military during the Intifada. I think a lot of people in America were very disturbed reading the reports of how the Israel military was behaving during the early part of the Intifada. Reports of clubbing, reports of shootings with plastic bullets, but reports that made it sound like there was an element of sadism being carried out as well, that somehow the Israeli response to the Intifada was bringing out a certain sadistic impulse on the part of some people in the military. Would you respond to that?
I think you are correct. I think we had the excesses, few of them with sort of sadistic overtones. It happens when an army of tens of thousands of soldiers is facing hundreds of thousands of Palestinians in an uneven confrontation. In many cases, the Israeli soldiers found themselves being attacked by big mobs of Palestinians, and they were prevented from shooting by order. So their response tended to be to club, and there was an instruction given at the time to this effect. I think that it took a few weeks before the Israelis, both the simple soldiers and the Defense Minister Rabin himself, to realize that clubbing was not the right answer to the situation where it was impossible and forbidden to shoot civilians. The Intifada as a whole is an impossible situation for an army to cope with. The army was not equipped and not trained to cope with such an open rebellion by masses of civilians. And it took a lot of time before the army had devised some tactics in order to prevent these frequent clashes between the Palestinians and the soldiers.
The Israeli military was called on to use clubs, to use plastic bullets, to shoot into crowds of civilians with men, women, and children. Did you find, Ehud Yahari, that the military was willing or reluctant to play this new role during the Intifada?
No doubt the Israeli military, by and large, was very reluctant to follow the advice which was given to the generals by some of the more reckless ministers in the Israeli government to disperse the Palestinian demonstrations with live ammunition. There were several confrontations between some of our hardline right-wing ministers and the chief of staff and the generals in command of the Southern Command and the Central Command, that is the areas where the West Bank and the Gaza Strip are, to the point that the chief of staff at one cabinet session offered his resignation. We have a very bizarre situation in Israel where usually it's the generals who are the hot-headed and the civilian ministers have to restrain them. This was the case when the French were fighting in Algeria. I think partly the case when you Americans were fighting in Vietnam. It was not the case in Israel. In Israel, the case was that young generals had to restrain older ministers and prevent the Intifada from becoming a bloodbath. And I think that every Israeli should take to our credit the fact that we are probably one of the only nations that is trying its officers and soldiers for excesses, for brutal behavior in the territories whenever this occurs, very, very shortly after it takes place. That is, we don't wait for this war, and the Intifada is a kind of war. We don't wait for this war to be over in order to try those who are to blame. Every soldier in the Israeli army and every officer, from the chief of staff down, knows that if he opens fire while he himself is not in danger, in danger to his life, he's going to be called to court. And I think that Palestinians, including the top leadership of the PLO, realize that the fact that the Israeli army is a popular army, is a civilian army with so many reservists, older people serving 1 month a year in the territories in all sorts of jobs, was the main reason why the Intifada did not finally deteriorate into a bloodbath. And there was a possibility that this could happen.
My guest is Ehud Yahari, and he's Middle East Affairs Correspondent for Israel Television and co-author with Zev Schiff of the new book, Intifada, the Palestinian Uprising, Israel's Third Front. You suggest that finally the Intifada has helped in its own way to set the stage for some kind of reconciliation between Palestinians and Israelis. What do you think the best hope is?
Well, the best hope is to try and turn the Intifada from a tragedy and the loss of human lives and an ugly event in many ways into an opportunity. The same way that the October War in 73 paved the way to peace between Israel and Egypt, I believe that in the same way the Intifada could serve as the starting point for the slow process of accommodation between Israelis and Palestinians. It depends on both Israelis and Palestinians. I mean, Israelis or Palestinians can make their own decisions, but what is needed here is a realization by both leaderships and both sides of the fence that the Intifada is something that calls for action. Otherwise, I believe that the danger is that Israelis will reach the conclusion that they can live with an ongoing Intifada, and therefore there is no need to do much about the conditions of lives of the Palestinians in the territories, and this would be a grave mistake. At the same time, Palestinians can reach the conclusion that a violent but unarmed struggle was not enough to get the Israelis out or to get the Israelis to sit to the table. And they will draw the conclusion that the next step should be to go back to firearms, terrorism, etc., etc., etc. So the Intifada will not stay as it is. It's a developing, changing war, fascinating in many ways to an outside observer, but very dangerous to people like me who happen to live there.
Do you think it's possible for Israel to be a democracy if it has occupied territories in which the people living there are not treated democratically?
Bluntly, the answer is no. I do believe that if the state of Israel has to impose curfew now and then upon hundreds of thousands of Palestinians for good security reasons, but nevertheless impose curfews, and if we have to keep sending our young soldiers to guard refugee camps and disperse civilian demonstrations, etc., if we will have to keep sending people on administrative detention without trial, without habeas corpus, finally it's going to eat the Israeli democracy from the inside. Many people in Israel are aware of that, and this is why I believe that having the right leadership, most Israelis will give it enough rope to try and get down and sit down with the Palestinians.
Ehud Ya'ari, he's the author with Zev Schiff of the new book Intifada. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.